It pleases the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, good afternoon. My name is Paul Wallace. I am here on behalf of the appellant, the State of Delaware, today.
It's interesting to see you sitting on that side of the room.
It's a little uncomfortable, Your Honor, actually. You know, the seats aren't quite the same there.
You notice they have different temperatures on the seats, too.
Yeah, they do.
One's a little warmer.
That's a lot hotter, I can tell you, most often for me. While it doesn't apply directly to this, to how this the state was able to bring this appeal, in 1996, the constitutional enactment and statutory enactment which permitted the state greater rights of appeal in certain cases noted that now the state would have an affirmative role in the development of our criminal law. I'd suggest respectfully that the state brings few appeals comparatively. We try to do it judiciously, we try to do it sparingly, but we try to do it on significant issues, and significant issues such as this one, where the day-to-day tasks under criminal procedure, under criminal law, and in this case, in public safety and well-being, are at question. The question in this case is whether an officer needs to meet the reasonable suspicion requirement, either generally or as a matter of constitutional law, or specifically under 1902, in order to engage in an encounter that's really voluntary, that is voluntarily consented to by a citizen. Where is the line? Does every time an officer in a uniform go to speak to a citizen, must there be reasonable suspicion? Certainly that's not the case law in this state, nor under the federal jurisprudence.
But before you get well into your argument, I have a fundamental concern, and that is I get the impression that the trial court was answering a different question than what you're asking us to answer. And specifically, it seems as if the trial court was simply being asked, if you have a detention under Section 1902, do you have to have the other bases in order to proceed with asking a question about what your identity is? There, it does not appear, if I understand the state's position on appeal, the state is saying 1902 doesn't cover every contact between a police officer and a citizen. And if you are not detaining a citizen, if you are not stopping them and putting them in a position where they can't move on, then you're certainly entitled to go up and say, hi, what's your name? Without any reasonable, articulable suspicion of anything. Am I correct that that's your position?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me how that position was presented to the trial court.
Well, I'd suggest that it was, because what the trial court did was it inserted 1902 to say, and I believe this is part of the difficulty with our Article 1, Section 6 jurisprudence since Jones, that what we are finding, and I suggest it even happened in this court last month in the argument in Williams, which is now going to come up in Bonk here, that in some way, every time a police officer does speak to someone and ask them their name, ask one of those four questions out of 1902, that in some way that converts to a seizure.
But wait a second. I don't want to get into the legal issues here. I want to get into what was presented to the trial court and whether this claim was raised below, because I'm reading what little bit there is of a transcript, and it sounds as if the trial court is saying, okay, so this person was stopped or detained or whatever, and now I have to decide whether under 1902 you can ask what their name is. And defense counsel said, that's right, you've made a finding that they are detained. The state, as far as I can tell, didn't say, no, Your Honor, we're claiming that there was no detention here at all. All there was a conversation, and that's different.
Your Honor, I believe that happened in the post-suppression hearing briefing. There was post-suppression hearing briefing, and in fact, the state was permitted to give cases to the trial court. And our argument was really both, that there wasn't a seizure to begin with, and 1902 really doesn't apply.
Well, the trial court made no reference to that. I mean, did she?
In its order?
Yeah.
I'd have to reread the order. Again, that was part of the problem we had with the trial court's decision, was that the trial court jumped directly to 1902 without first determining whether or not a seizure had occurred, because 1902 really doesn't take effect, or doesn't. It's the statutory equivalent of Terry. It really doesn't come into play until there has been that seizure.
Well, Mr. Wallace, just to not to put too fine a point on Justice Berger's question, our concern is that either the argument that you're making now wasn't fairly presented below, or it was fairly presented below and the trial court ignored it. I mean, it's got to be one or the other, because in the opinion, or letter opinion, there is no reference to your argument. It's as though it hadn't been made.
I believe it was the latter. I'd have to double-check what exactly was submitted to the court after the hearing. I honestly think that the trial prosecutor was kind of caught a bit off guard when the judge jumped directly to 1902 without that first step, and my belief, and like I said, I have to look at the post-trial submissions or the post-hearing submissions again, was that was raised, that both things had to be addressed, but that first the question is, was there a seizure here?
Do we have a sufficient factual finding record by the trial judge? Because I know you're arguing this is a consensual encounter, but those words don't appear in the trial judge's written order, do they?
No.
And we don't have any detail as to what the actual conversation was. I picked up what I thought was first testimony that a question was asked, is it okay if I speak with you? We're doing an investigation, permission's given, and then what's your name? Was asked. And then there's later testimony or inquiry by the judge, what's the first thing out of your mouth to the officer? And the officer says, what's your name? Was the first thing out of his mouth. So, I mean, are these differences that are relevant to the issue of whether it's a consensual encounter or not? And isn't your case stronger, for instance, if the finding is, may I talk with you, and you get an affirmative yes, as opposed to four officers coming up, what's your name?
Yes, it is certainly the first.
Do we have that resolved?
I don't know that the judge, certainly in the judge's order, other than explaining that she does find the officers to be credible, but I guess the question ends up, it begs the question, which, if there are two different versions, I don't know that there are two different versions necessarily, but which is it?
Well, the other thing that's unclear, the judge, on page 2 and 3 of the judge's opinion, uses the word detain. And the judge concludes there's a detention. And you keep characterizing this as a police officer walking up to have a chat. But looking at the record and looking at the opinion, the judge seems to put some focus on the fact that there were four police officers, not a single police officer. Wouldn't it be important for us to know whether the judge thought four officers would constitute a detention and maybe one would not?
Certainly those are some facts. Because of this court's the test that this court set forth in Jones as to whether a reasonable person would have been able to ignore it.
I'm talking about Jones, but the Superior Court judge relied on the statute. At the end, the Superior Court says both parts of the Constitution were violated, but the Superior Court judge's opinion is tied to the statute and a detention under the statute.
And that's wherein the state has the problem, because we believe that the court jumped to 1902 by saying, as soon as you ask that is a detention. And our suggestion is no, there was no detention to begin with, and so you are free to ask those questions.
Well, that's where we're having trouble with the facts, because it wasn't clear to the court, you can see from our questions, that that's what the Superior Court ruling was. it also isn't clear to us how important it was that four people were asking the question. You know, one of them was speaking, but four of them were there.
Right.
Well, let me point you to the language that has me concerned, which is on A12. The court says that she's interested in receiving any additional cases and so forth. And Mr. Goff says, you have made a determination that a reasonable person in his position would believe that they were not free to go. That has already been decided by you, so I'm not going to argue that. The only question is, unless Your Honor is saying otherwise, the court, I'm saying I don't even need to get there, because if the detention isn't lawful, then any statements he makes pursuant to the detention are excluded. So I don't need to make that factual finding unless you tell me I'm in error by not making it. Mr. Goff, being a good defense attorney, says, I don't think so. And that seems to tee up exactly the point that you're talking about here, and yet, surprisingly, then there's no discussion of it.
I understand that, Your Honor, and all I can tell the court is I believe that was then, when later cases were submitted, that specific issue was readdressed about missing the first step in the analysis, going directly to saying there was a detention without really analyzing the facts as to whether or not there were a detention and some of the facts that the court has brought out. What, as a factual matter, were the words spoken? It seemed that the record does fairly, the state suggests, fairly represents that this was a, you know, may we speak to you? I don't know that there, and the judge said, I find the police officers to be credible. So I think that we would accept those facts.
But they didn't testify to what the defendant believed he was compelled to do by their presence,
no.
By their demeanor, by their tone. There's no finding that he believed he was free not to answer and was free to walk away.
That's true. All they were able to testify to.
In essence, to assume that it was just a walk up in a chattable,
well,
night talk show kind of way,
no, but
brother kind of thing. Right?
I think that from the facts that we have, we always have to look at it from the outside, not necessarily the subjective belief of the defendant, but what are the facts from the outside. And the only testimony we have are from the police officers explaining what their activity was.
Well, that's because we have this dilemma of whether that was even addressed either by further testimony or comment on the testimony, particularly in light of what Justice Berger just read, which if I were sitting as the trial judge would lead me to conclude that that was no longer an issue, that I was where I ought to be.
Well, I suggest, Your Honor, that once the judge jumped forward, it was very difficult, and I think the opinion rendered by the judge eventually made it clear that judge did not or immediately believe that there was attention. But the reason is this misreading. Excuse me?
Yeah. And what did you say the judge did not believe?
Or did believe that there was a detention really as soon as the police officers came up.
How would you characterize the factual basis for her conclusion there was a detention?
The only thing I suggest that makes sense out of reading the record, reading what the judge says as to the transcripts, and then reading her post-hearing opinion is that the police officers approached and asked, and during that approach asked for a name. That as soon as a name is asked for, that's detention. And the state's suggestion is that's simply not true. That can't be the law.
Well, she could have found implicitly that it may be one thing if one policeman comes up to a defendant and wants to talk, but here there was a gang of four, three of whom were out on the street, and that was a lot more menacing than simply one officer approaching.
That's one way to read it. I mean, Your Honor, with all due respect to the court, these are four officers on bike patrol. I mean, these are officers in bike shorts, wearing, you know, bike helmets. How menacing that is, I don't know. But this is
well,
these
they
are
all, they all carried sidearms, didn't they?
I assume they did.
Maybe batons.
I'm trying to think of what the Wilmington police officers wear.
Bikes give them sort of a kiddie core aura.
But my point is, what it is consistent is with is what we're asking police officers to do every day, and that is community policing. And that's what they were doing in this case. They were they had gotten a tip. They had been alerted to problems at this particular house. And so what did they do? While they were on bike patrol that day, in the middle of the day, they see two people. They go up and they ask, can we speak to you?
Well, but I don't see that in the judge's findings.
Well, the factual findings by the judge are unfortunately, she never clarifies what are the facts I find other than I think he was detained right then.
Well, she gets into some detail. They observed two individuals sitting on the front steps. One of the individuals was the defendant. They asked the individuals for their names. The defendant and his companion provided their names. That just sort of glaringly omits this consensual encounter evidence.
But even if the police officers went up and asked for their names, Your Honor, what this court is saying and what if the Superior Court is saying is the first question out of a police officer's mouth can't be, what's your name, or else it's a seizure, then again, police are going to be handcuffed in doing anything that is reasonable in the way of community policing, in the way of answering a tip much like this.
Well, we're back to square one, though, on that, because that assumes that the argument that you're making to us now was made to the trial judge, who would have immediately been attuned to everything you're saying and would have analyzed the case perhaps differently. Had that been articulated to her as you are articulating it to us?
All I can tell the court is I believe that it was after the hearing. It may not have been right at the hearing, but that's part of the reason the judge had asked for further submissions.
But you've got to develop the facts at the hearing, don't you? When you do your post-hearing briefing, you're limited to what facts were presented at the hearing. You may not be limited in all your argument about the facts, but Justice Richard just read the only facts that constituted findings. Was there more in the transcript that the trial judge just ignored?
Well, as Justice Ridgely pointed out, when the police officer first testified, he said, we're doing an investigation, may we speak to you? Later on, when asked again, he said, I think I asked them their name first. but even taking the facts as the judge found them, the state respectfully suggests it's not a detention. It's not one which violates either Article 1, Section 6, or which violates the Fourth Amendment.
Basically, you're saying 1902 is irrelevant. None of that analysis applies because this was all a voluntary discussion. But again, and I think it should be clear by now that we're hung up on the question of whether that argument was ever fairly made below. It's your burden to demonstrate that it was. If it was made below, tell us where in the record we can find it. The answers that we've gotten from you don't exactly inspire confidence because in response to the direct question, you said, well, I believe we did. And then you go on and make an argument that sounds like, and if we didn't, it's only because the judge made up her mind about a fundamental premise of this argument and, you know, the lawyer that argued it below was intimidated into not making the argument. I mean, I'm not sure where we are here.
If I could step away for a moment, I might have the response, the post-suppression briefing that might make that a little clearer. The state did submit on April 30th, was a letter which provided this court's case of Rashawn Miller versus State.
In your memo, your brief there, in this court, you rely heavily on Florida versus Royer, Ross versus State. Did you cite Florida and Ross to the Superior Court in that memo?
No, we did not.
But that's really the two lead cases on appeal in this court, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And that is because the state's argument is that the Superior Court, when it made its decision, missed that first step.
Well, that's what we were asking you, you seemed to say the trial prosecutor was caught by surprise, but then with detached reflection, as I understood your argument, kind of figured out what was going on when they did the briefing before the judge ruled. And if that was the case, you would expect to see Florida versus Royer and Ross versus State in the memo, because you'd be giving the judge a chance to fix the problem with starting with an assumption that there's a detention.
I think I agree with the court, and I think that may have been a failing of ours in not making that clear enough to the court that it had skipped that first portion. But that was mainly because I believe what we are seeing of courts jumping directly to the, if you ask those four questions, you automatically are in 1902 land. And our argument on appeal, because that's where the judge found the error lied here, that there was a violation of 1902, is that's not true.
Well, I agree with what you said, but I still don't understand why, if you're saying to the judge, we want to help you see the error of your ways, so to speak, and it is that you don't have a problem under 1902, because if you look at Ross versus State and Florida versus Royer, it's never even implicated at this stage of the contact.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that have been helpful to the court?
Yes, it certainly would, because that is that, as the state's arguing here, there is that step that you must get to before 1902 is implicated in any way.
And we're also accustomed to seeing if issues are fairly presented to the trial judge in their order or their opinion, setting forth the position of the parties and explaining why she accepts or rejects the facts that are put to her and the legal issues as they're applied to the facts. And I don't read where the trial judge has said the state argues in post-trial briefing that there was no detention at all, and then rejects that argument on the basis of some analysis that we can review, both in terms of whether she abused her discretion in finding the facts or whether she erred as a matter of law by the application of the wrong law to those facts.
I believe that's probably a failure by the state in not making it clear enough to the trial court, because as I look at the post-submission briefing, there was much more time spent on perhaps there was, in fact, reasonable articulable suspicion to underlie the court's 1902 finding, and therefore the court probably would not take that step back. The state suggests, however, that by making that 1902 finding right off the bat, that the court did miss a crucial step.
I understand it, but do you think, in all honesty, that this is the case for us to seize, given this record and the way in which the issues were presented to the trial court, the opportunity to address the policy arguments that you began with today?
No, but and my greatest concern is the factual record that the court is concerned about, and that is exactly what was said and how much weight the court placed on how many officers and their placement, because those are objective facts from the outside that, unless they are clarified by the lower court, would make it very difficult for this court to determine whether the initial finding of a detention is appropriate, and therefore 1902 should be the court's finding that 1902 plays a part should be reviewed.
Are you suggesting that we remand this?
I do believe it should be remanded. I think that's the most prudent course, mainly because of the very factual questions that the court has raised, which I think are of greatest import, because they play a part in the state's argument, and they play a part in the court's finding. And I don't know that those were drawn out enough to make it clear what the judge was relying on to say there's a detention, and therefore the 1902 questions could not have been asked because reasonable articulable suspicion did not underlie that. I have 26 seconds. I don't know that I'm going to use it.
All right.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. This is Robert Goff for the appellee. In this case, the defendant, Timothy Meads. I can tell that basically what the court is addressing is whether or not there's a sufficient record below to make a determination of either whether Mr. Wallace's point is correct or whether my point is correct, which essentially leaves, I think, the court with an issue which wasn't addressed in either one of our briefs, and that is whether the court should remand under these circumstances or take it as a waiver, so to speak, of that argument. I think that one justice, and forgive me for my memory not being that very strong on the issue, did bring up the point that it's the state's burden under these type of circumstances at a suppression hearing to prove a consensual type of encounter with a citizen on the street.
Well, since we're all gathered here today, tell the court why everything that happened here, as you understand it or as you read the record, would not be permitted under Florida versus Royer.
Okay. I think that a lot of it has to do with our differing viewpoints, Your Honor, on the standard of review in this case. The state standard of review, as it's indicated, is they believe that the judge below made a mistake as to a matter of law, and therefore this review is de novo. My own statement of the standard review in our brief is that I believe that this case presents a mixed law and fact question, and I think that's supported by the case that I cited there. To the extent that a factual determination or mixed fact law determination is made that there's a detention, that is something that is within the discretion of a trial judge to make, that there is, when the eyes on appeal peer at these questions, there is a certain latitude that is given to a trial judge, and that this court will not necessarily overturn it, even though you might if you were looking at yourself.
And what would you say, what is the factual basis for the finding that there was a detention?
I think there are a couple of facts that, frankly, aren't mentioned by the trial judge in her opinion, because, as it's been noted by, I believe, Justice Ridgely in reading that opinion, there wasn't a whole lot there.
But they are in the record.
I think there is some additional material in the record that would support a reasonable finding of the judge below in determining that there was a detention at that point in time. As we've defined, as Your Honors have defined in Jones, a detention is wider under our Delaware Constitution than under the United States Constitution. And I think the language that is cited in both of our briefs is that if a person on the street feels that they are not feels that they're not free to ignore what's going on there, in this particular case, the questioning of the police as to their identity, then that person is detained under Delaware law and under Jones. That has not been changed by the Ross decision. Ross is simply a gloss on separate facts. The additional facts that aren't really cited by the trial judge, I think, are, as Your Honors have pointed out, that these were uniformed officers. Whether one thinks that a bicycle outfit is not imposing or not, I have no idea, but they were armed. There were four of them. They were in close proximity to the persons that were being stopped. They were immediately questioned. There is some question as to what exactly was said during that conversation, as Justice Ridgely has pointed out. In addition to that, there's a further fact in the transcript that in which one of the officers characterized the proximity of the four officers. And that is, and there's an additional fact, I'm sorry, before I forget, and that is that the identification of either one or both, and frankly the officers didn't remember, identification, their license was taken from them at that point in time. To then say that this individual would feel free to leave at that point in time, while the identification process is ongoing, I think belies what fairly can be expected from a person out on the street.
Let me ask you to assume slightly different facts. Assume there's only one police officer and he doesn't get too close to the potential defendant and doesn't have, you know, any kind of particularly authoritative demeanor other than the fact that he's a police officer, is it your position that any time a police officer goes up to a citizen and says, "What's your name?" that that is a detention because, as opposed to asking, "Can I talk to you?" or "Would you mind stopping? I'd like to talk to you," or anything that's a kind of introductory asking permission, this is a demand, "I want to know your name. I'm a police officer," that the person in response would reasonably believe that he had to answer the question.
The first scenario that Your Honor presented, I think, would definitely not be a constitutionally recognized detention. It doesn't merely meet the standard of what Your Honors have defined as a detention under our state constitution. So I don't think that every contact between an individual and a person on the street where a question is asked would constitute a detention. I don't know if that fully answers Your Honor's question.
Mr. Goff, let's go back for a moment to the threshold issue, which is whether the claim that's being, the claim of error that's being argued here was fairly presented below. Either it was or it wasn't. What is your position?
My position would be that the state bore the burden of presenting that claim clearly in the record before it. It additionally had additional time and was given the opportunity to present that claim in a written finding. They could have requested additional hearing at that point in time. Therefore, they didn't ask for an additional hearing, and didn't really argue it at great length in the.
Saying that the claim was not fairly presented below?
I think it was waived and not presented below, Your Honor, and that's a thought that has come to mind. Again, I apologize during the process of Your Honor's questioning of Mr. Wallace concerning this. Essentially, my argument, as I've stated, is that we do not have a situation where there was a clear error on the part of the judge. Perhaps we have a situation where there was an absence of material presented by the party that bore the burden. Under those circumstances, a judge could fairly find detention to the extent that that was even an issue at that hearing. So unless the court has any further questions of me, I'm going to stop.
I do have a question. I'm struggling at the moment to find the statute. But did I understand you to begin by saying that under the statute that authorizes the state to take an appeal, that this case and the argument they're making doesn't fall within that statute?
No, I would not argue that, Your Honor. I think that that's not the case. Clearly, the state can appeal suppression decisions after a proper dismissal has been done, as it was done here.
I thought you were trying to tell us that the state could appeal when it was purely a question of law, a misapplication of the Delaware or the United States Constitution in that situation, but not when either the appeal is taken on the basis of suppression because the judge got the facts incorrect, or that in a case where there's a mixed question of law, in fact, they couldn't take an appeal.
Your Honor, that was not my intention to make that argument, so I apologize if I misled the court.
Misunderstood what you said entirely. I just wanted to clear it up.
I just said that our standards of review, as stated in our briefs, were different, and that my standard that I suggested was more deferential.
I'd like to ask one question about whether this was fairly presented below. This is pages 19 and 20 of the transcript. Ms. Gatto, I believe the state's position in this case is that they were just asking him for information at that point. They volunteered to give their ID, volunteered for a pat-down search, that they weren't in custody. Doesn't that support a consensual encounter?
That argument does support a consensual encounter, Your Honor.
Okay, so it was presented, at least that argument was made, that it was a consensual encounter.
Those things were said by the prosecutor in the case, yes, Your Honor. Okay. Thank you, Justices.
All right, thank you, Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.